All of them are very vocal about their experiences around race. We have had an increasing number of conversations about race over the past few months, and I've become much more conscious of conversations that we've had over the years. When my boys started driving, I told them to text me when they finished school, and I told them to come straight home. I didn't want them hanging around places after school and coming home late. We lived in the most affluent section of the county. I warned the boys to check their speed and always be sure they weren't driving above the speed limit, in case anyone thought that they were in a place they didn't belong. I talked to them about the protocol, what to do if you get pulled over. I did that automatically as a matter of course. About a year and a half ago, I discovered that my white friends don't have these conversations with their kids. And the next question, have you had a conversation like that with your sighted daughters? And Jackie Anderson replies, Amia is only 13, so we're not there quite yet. But my older daughter, Corrine, I've had a talk somewhat similar to my conversation with the boys. The onus is on them to make sure the person they're talking to is comfortable. The next question, that choice of words is interesting to me because as blind people, we often talk about how the onus is on us to help sighted people feel comfortable. It's not that we will be in physical danger if people are uncomfortable with us, but our opportunities to get a job or rent an apartment to make our way in the world often depend on our ability to make people feel comfortable around us. And Jackie Anderson replies, definitely, I totally agree. Karen Anderson posted that same sentiment on Facebook a few weeks ago. She said that making that connection has helped her, as a blind person who is white, relate to what black people are talking about. She can make that connection as a white person who is blind. It's real for her. Next question. Still, I'm a bit wary of suggesting that people in the blind community are more empathetic than others around racial issues. There's a stereotype that says blind people are oblivious to color, so therefore blind people don't have color prejudice and can't be racist. And the reply, oh, that's a great fallacy. Sure, a lot of sighted people make that assumption. It's based on the idea that racism is based on color, but it's not. Actually, I think skin color is the least important aspect of racism. We humans are so complex. So many different experiences shape our mindsets. I've had conversations with several blind people around the issue of having to make others feel comfortable, and they get it, that this is something the blind community and the black community both experience. But I've also had conversations with white people who are blind, and they don't get it at all. Their other lived experience of whiteness is more dominant in shaping their perception. And in the same ways, I've talked to people who are not blind who are having a very hard time wrapping their heads around the whole discussion of race. The bottom line is the question of which aspects of your lived experience inform you who you are. Which is the dominant piece? An individual who is blind may know the experience of having to check the comfort level of the person they're interacting with. But still, that may not be their dominant lived experience. Their level of empathy may really depend on their dominant lived experience. And the next question, when do you think about ways for parents to help their kids have a deeper understanding about race and racial issues? Are there things that might be helpful for them to discuss? And the reply, I think the first thing you need to do is acknowledge that racism and prejudice exist. When they're young, our kids only know what we share with them. If your children only learn about people from your own culture and socioeconomic background, that's all they will know. If the only information they hear about another community is negative, that's what they will absorb. Who are the characters in the literature we present to our kids? Is there diversity in their books and movies? If you take your children to a museum, do you ever go to a museum that exposes them to African-American art and culture? We need for everyone to have cross-cultural exposure. You need to be purposeful to find these opportunities, but they do exist. We now have access to so much more than we had a few decades ago, and we still need so much more. Diversity isn't just about white and black cultures. When we first had the lockdown last March, I told my kids that we were going to use the time to do research on some different countries. I said, quote, let's not research the countries we hear about all the time, like Mexico or France. Let's study countries we don't hear about much at all, unquote. It took some pushing. We have to be intentional about it. So much exists in our world, and if we only keep looking at the same things over and over, there is no growth. And the final question, that means pushing ourselves beyond our comfort zones. And Jackie Anderson's final reply, not long ago, a mother I've been working with texted me, and she said, quote, Jackie, I really want to respond to the discussion of racism and Black Lives Matter. I want it to be meaningful, and I don't want to be offensive, unquote. We went back and forth for quite a while, and I explained how my upbringing in Jamaica is different from the experiences of so many Black people raised in the United States. Finally, my answer to her question was, quote, whatever you share is okay, as long as it's authentic to you, unquote. We've started the discussion. People are talking, and this is the only way change will occur. When I share, what I share may have an impact on how you behave or what you believe, but that can only happen if we start to talk. And here's a quick announcement from the National Federation of the Blind. Santa loves blind people, and Santa loves Braille. Santa Claus has made the staff at the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute honorary elves. He has asked us to help him send letters in Braille to very young blind boys and girls, those under the age of 10, in the United States. Between November 9th and December 16th, parents can go online at www.nfb.org/santa-letters. That's www.nfb.org/santa-letters. And fill out a Santa Braille letter request form. The form can also be printed and faxed to area code 410-685-2340 or emailed to communityrelations@nfb.org. Beginning on Monday, November 30th, the Braille letters from Santa will start going out to boys and girls around the country. The Braille letter will also be accompanied by a print copy for mom and dad to read, as well as some other fun Christmas time activities. The deadline for letter requests is December 16th, so to ensure that a return letter in Braille is received before Christmas. For more information, please visit our website at www.nfb.org. And that wraps up this week's edition of the Blindness and Disability News Hour. This program covers the week of November 15th, 2020, and as always is a production of Mind's Eye Radio in Belleville, Illinois, although we are continuing to record remotely. My name is Bill. Thanks very much for joining us. Please stay safe, stay in unless you really have to. Wear a mask, wash your hands, use the hand sanitizer. You guys know the drill. But we really want you to keep healthy and safe. So do so, and we'll see you all here next week.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Western Magazines, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 Mockingbird Lane, is offering curbside adoptions, vaccines, warmer, and more. Shelter hours are from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Only one person is allowed in the office and kennels at this time. For applications, vaccine, or additional information, call 381-5503 or 257-4311 or email shelter@odessahumanesociety.org. To see current pets available or to private message the shelter, visit www.facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa.
If you've ever had mishaps on Thanksgiving, that's nothing compared to the Turkey Day zaniness of Jack Benny, Burns and Allen, Abbott and Costello, and Milton Berle. This week, we're bringing you 8 old-time radio Thanksgiving classics that include those radio stars, as well as Father Knows Best and The Life of Riley. Hear these old-time radio Thanksgiving classics Monday through Wednesday at 1 p.m. and Friday at noon from Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 48 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Programs almost single-handedly bringing the disease under control. The price of inheritance. The widow King, though frail, survived her husband by 40 years. When Robert Clayburgh and Alice King were married in 1886, Henrietta King accompanied them on their honeymoon. This sharing of their postnuptial right established a pattern that continued until her death in 1925. Mrs. King's bedroom in the old frame ranch house was directly across the hall from theirs. When that house burned in 1912, the custom of close family living carried over to the grand hacienda known as the Big House that looms over the Santa Gertrudis to this day. Mrs. King presided at the dinner table and was quite free with advice on how the young couple should raise their 5 children. They never had a life of their own until they themselves were near death. That was the price they paid for their inheritance. For decades, the King Ranch was known as the Widow's Ranch, and Mrs. King, dressed always in black, set the tone for it. Twice a year, she toured the ranch in her heavy black Rockaway coach, and she was, in fact, if not always in practice, the boss of the place. She gave Robert Clayburgh authority and respect, but she never stepped entirely aside. A woman of unflagging charity and Christian determination, she still expected to receive her due as pioneer, founder, and owner. At times, she no doubt made the Clayburghs' lives utterly miserable. But Mrs. King's fussy presence was only a minor source of misery compared with the South Texas climate. It was no more fit for proper Victorians than the steamy plains of India were. The vaquero men and women wore light cottons. The Clayburgh men suffered under wool trousers, high boots, stiff collars, suspenders, and wool coats. The women were gussied up in layers of chemises, petticoats, whalebone corsets, and heavy cloth from head to foot. Dressed like that, simply to survive a South Texas August was a triumph. Mrs. King would not allow the men to dine at her table in shirt sleeves, no matter how hot the day. And so they would sit through dinner, sweating profusely. If the windows were opened, the wind would cover the plates with dust. If it were a bit cooler, the mosquitoes would descend in clouds. Even so, after dinner, the family members would entertain each other, putting on skits, telling stories, reading aloud, and singing songs, always closing with Mrs. King's favorite, Rock of Ages. The new generation, the Clayburghs' 2 boys and 3 girls, grew up on the ranch in spirit, even though they spent the school year in Corpus Christi. Their father delighted in sending a stagecoach drawn by magnificent white horses to meet them at the train stop. The horses whisked them away on what must have been a heady ride across 20 miles of prairie to the threshold of the ranch house. When the railroad finally came to Kingsville, the railroad manager sent a special engine and a caboose every Friday to take the children from Corpus Christi out to the ranch. Alice King Clayburgh, for her part, stayed in her mother's shadow and deferred to her husband, a model of self-denial. But she harbored in her heart a warm spot for her father's flamboyance. Her first son, Richard Mifflin Clayburgh, was her favorite. He was dashing, talented and athletic. He mastered languages, golf, the guitar, and the piano, all with ease. He was a natural diplomat with a flair for dramatic gestures and could deliver moving speeches in Spanish, German, and English. He would sit with his mother for hours, playing his guitar and singing songs. But Robert Kleeberg, while he admired his elder son's talents, placed his faith in Robert Kleeberg Jr., his second son. Bob had to work harder for what he got. Shorter than Richard, he was also less athletic and graceful. He had a terrible ear for languages and music, and a soft, squeaky voice unsuited to public speaking. He liked books, but did not take to schools. He pulled his share of pranks, but in contrast to Richard, he was a serious and earnest young man, just the sort to inspire confidence in his father and the widow king. Richard Kleeberg, as befitted his talents, became the ranch's emissary to the world at large. He looked after its interests in Congress from 1932 to 1944, and gave a young Texan named Lyndon Johnson his first job in Washington. He was something of a legend there. He often drove up to the Capitol in a stripped-down King Ranch hunting car like the one Buick made for him, trimmed in sterling silver, with compartments for guns, ammunition, and liquor. Bob, however, was given the responsibility of the ranch. Captain King himself had skipped over the most obvious error in favor of a man better suited to the task. That tradition, more than anything else, enabled the family to sustain itself when an aristocracy that gave everything to the firstborn would have failed. And no one proved the tradition's worth more eloquently than Bob Kleeberg. In the Captain's Image. 100 years almost to the day after Richard King established his first cow camp on the Santa Gertrudis, Bob Kleeberg stood on a rise in Queensland and gazed out on the vast red den sweep of the Australian outback. The country was raw desert, worked desultorily by a few settlers and aborigines whose occasional travel sent whirlwinds of dust across the steppes. But Bob Kleeberg saw in that Australian wilderness precisely what his grandfather had seen in the grassy, forsaken wild horse desert of South Texas. He saw the makings of an empire. By the time he finally satisfied that vision, he had added 8 million acres of Australian land on long-term leases to the 825,000 or so his family owned in Texas. He also left his mark on every aspect of the original ranch. He led it through the tumultuous decade following the death of Henrietta King in 1925. He survived bitter court battles with his cousins over the division of the ranch. He weathered the Depression and its catastrophic effect on ranch profits. He engineered a deal with Humble Oil for the ranch's oil and gas rights that put it permanently on a sound financial footing. And he developed an entirely new breed of cattle that was to the cattle business what the Model A Ford was to the car business. He was, by any definition, a genius. Like his brother and sisters, Bob Kleeberg grew up on the ranch. He learned to ride at 4 and to cut, rope, and shoot soon after. His mentors were his cousin Cesar Kleeberg, ranch foreman Sam Raglan, and the Caninos. Cesar was the family eccentric. He ran the southern sector of the ranch from a weathered old ranch house at Marias that had neither electricity nor plumbing. The railroad tracks cut through the front yard. The bathtub was on the front porch, and cots did for beds. The place was so cluttered, it was rumored that nothing that went in ever came out, except occasionally Cesar himself. As a boy, Bob lived with Sam Raglan in the foreman's cottage next to the big house. Raglan and Cesar, as well as Caninos, like Agustin Quintanilla and Faustino Villa, who had been with Captain King on the river, made the younger Kleeberg's son their apprentice. He was a quick learner. With their help, he trained his eyes, his ears, and his nose to pick up the subtle variations that told him, as if by instinct, which calves would breed best, which clouds carried rain, which plant stung, and which one healed. Bob's early ambition was to be an inventor, and later the stirrings of youthful independence caused him to announce that he was going to be an engineer. But the onset of his father's palsy and World War I changed that. He came home to run the ranch in 1918 after only 2 years of college, and for all practical purposes, he did not leave it for 20 years. The ranch divided. In 1925, at the age of 92, the widow of the King Ranch died. At Henrietta King's Beer were bankers from the East, railroad executives, oil men, politicians. There were also hundreds of Quinanos, some of whom had ridden for 2 days from the ranch's far divisions. Unbidden, they led the funeral procession into the town cemetery, a few miles from where her husband had first brought her to the uninhabited frontier more than 70 years before. Then they circled the open grave on horseback at a fast canter, their hats held at their sides. Mrs. King's death threw the ranch into crisis. The estate taxes and the depression that soon followed dragged the ranch more than $3 million into debt, to the edge of financial ruin. And more ominously, the huge empire built by the riverboat captain had to be divided among his heirs for the first time. That complex and, in some cases, bitter process consumed an entire decade. It was Bob Coburg's first great test. Mrs. King's will called for her daughter Alice to receive the northern tier of the ranch, the Santa Gertrudis and Laurelis divisions. The southern sector was divided among her other heirs, with the children of Richard King Jr. receiving the Santa Fe Ranch to the west. The Atwoods, heirs of Mrs. King's eldest daughter Nettie, from whom she had long been estranged, never having approved of her marriage to an army officer, received El Suaz on the south. The Cleburns got the northeastern portion known as the Nuras Division, to which they added the shares of two other heirs who sold out to them. In the early 20s, knowing his family was going to lose most of the sandy pasture in the southern sector, Bob Cleburg had bought a sandy ranch north of Farfolias to create another division, the Encino, just north of the Santa Fe Ranch. Of the ranch's 1.2 million acres, the Cleburgs ended up with more than 800,000. Throughout the 10 years between Mrs. King's death in 1925 and the final partition in 1935, Bob Cleburg, the youngest trustee, ran the ranch for the heirs. He ran it without hesitation and with a zeal that angered the Atwoods. They fought the will bitterly, challenged his trusteeship, raged over his imperial manner, and fumed that he charged his freewheeling escapades to the estate. Led on by their Chicago lawyer, the Atwoods refused to take El Suaz and sued the ranch for nearly 20 years, all the while living in comparative poverty on a modest allowance Mrs. King had given them in her will. Estranged, lonely, and resentful, one of them bequeathed her estate to a Chicago policeman who had treated her kindly. The lawyer ended up with well over half of El Suaz in return for masterminding what was, by the time it was finally settled in the 50s, the longest suit in Texas history. To manage their holdings, in 1934, the Cleburgs incorporated the King Ranch, which meant that the descendants of Richard King Jr. would no longer be a part of the ranch that bore their name. Each of the five children of Alice King and Robert Cleburg Sr. got one-fifth of the stock, each which they pooled in a trust set up to last until 1954, when they or their heirs would control the stock individually. The intent was clear. After suffering through the tense decade following Mrs. King's death, Bob Cleburg, his brother Richard, and their three sisters were pledging to keep the King Ranch together. The incorporation of the ranch was the beginning of its modern history. It was no longer one man's empire. Now it belonged to a growing family whose members would have to agree on its destiny. In 1934, there were only five stockholders. In two generations, there would be more than 60. Corporate politics, meaning family politics, would decide the ranch's future, even if the will, charisma, and above all, the longevity of Bob Kleberg would obscure that fact for four decades. Back in the early 30s, however, Bob worried less about how his heirs would run the ranch than about making sure they would have something to run. Neither the Atwoods, the land, nor the future was the biggest thorn in his side. Money was. Playing the oil card. Ranchers have traditionally been land poor, long on acres, short on cash. Ever since the brief halcyon years of the cattle boom following the Civil War, the King Ranch had seldom earned more than $100,000 or $5,200,000 a year in profit from all its ranching operations. Some years it lost money. In the 30s, however, drought so parched the ranch's pastures that its cattle were starving. Yet there was no point in buying feed for them. Fat steers were selling for a pitiful 3.5 cents a pound. The King Ranch unloaded thousands of head and earned in return barely enough to pay for shipping them to market. It was a grim period. Bob's cousin Richard King, who was still with the ranch then, spent all his time on trains, trying to stay ahead of the ranch's creditors by floating new loans to pay off the old ones coming due. Throughout the crisis, the elder Kleberg, the older German lawyer who had bested a riverboat captain in court, still got in his car every afternoon and had himself driven around the ranch, his blue eyes staring out at the barren plains, his once fertile mind now made helpless by a stroke. The pressure on Bob to sell off big chunks of the ranch, to throw into the fire the only asset it had left, its land, became overwhelming. No one saw any way out. But Bob obstinately and unreasonably refused to sell land. "Selling is easy," he would say. "Collecting is hard." He looked instead to something else the ranch possessed beneath its surface. He looked to oil. In 1933, Bob Kleberg tried to persuade several oil companies to take a lease on the ranch. Gulf, Shell, and Texaco turned him down. Humber Oil did not. In return for a loan that would assume all the ranch's $3 million debt, then held by numerous investors in the form of King Ranch notes, and in return for a royalty interest and enough bonus payments to meet the interest on the loan, Bob granted Humble the right to search for oil and gas on the more than 1 million acres the family controlled before the partition. When the deal was closed, Humble had possession of what was then the largest oil and gas lease in the world, and the ranch provided, as many oil men doubted, that there was oil under its pastures, was on sound financial footing at last. Using the primitive geological survey methods of the time, Humble spent the next 6 years trying to discover just where to drill its first well. It was like firing a rocket into space, not knowing where the planets were and expecting to hit something, a veteran of the early exploration recalled. In 1939, Humble began drilling in the sections adjacent to proven fields outside the ranch. It was not until 1945, 12 years after the lease was signed, that they went after new fields with their first Wildcat well. It hit. 2 years later, the ranch had raked in $3.25 million in royalties from fields that the Oil and Gas Journal estimated would be second to East Texas in oil and second to Amarillo and natural gas. By 1953, there were 650 producing wells on the ranch. The relationship between the King Ranch and Humble was based on a simple understanding. The King Ranch might be an oil field to Humble, but it was still a ranch to Bob Coburg. For example, when the first oil well was no longer a producer, it was converted to a water well and used to fill stock tanks. Oil has been a considerate guest. Pumps, rigs, gas lines, and equipment are kept up to the standard of appearance of the ranch, which, not so incidentally, got with its royalties a free system of roads and free natural gas. The free gas eventually became something of a headache for Humble. On one memorable occasion, the top executives of Standard Oil, Humble, and other oil companies were house guests of Henrietta Larkin Armstrong, Bob's sister. Henrietta was an enthusiastic gardener. That night, a blue norther sent the temperature in South Texas into the 20s, so Henrietta set out dozens of gas stoves to keep her plants from freezing. Sometime after midnight, the stoves stopped working. With undeniable logic, she rousted all the oil company presidents and board chairmen out of their beds with the command, "You all know everything about gas. Get up and fix my stoves." They did, and not long after that, gave up supplying the ranch with free gas from their wells and installed propane tanks instead. An artist of genetics. Bob Coburg not only saved the ranch, he also transformed it. Like Henry Ford, with whom he had a great deal in common, he loved to tinker. Were the mesquite thickets getting worse? He invented a root plow driven by a massive bulldozer that could clear 4 acres an hour. Were the native grasses thin and unnourishing? He developed his own grasses, some of which are now used around the world. Was the grass deficient in nutrients? He devised a phosphorus supplement that made cattle healthier. Was it difficult to move cattle into pens? He invented the cattle prod, based on the design for a fly electrocutor he was experimenting with. The list goes on and on, but his most inventive work was in breeding. By World War I, the longhorn, like the buffalo, had vanished from the frontier. But the English breeds that replaced it suffered mightily in the South Texas heat. Most of the year they ran a fever just from standing in the sun. Their skin was too tight to allow much evaporation and too thin to resist screwworms, ticks, and other insects. They gained weight poorly when fed just grass, yet grass was what the King Ranch had in abundance. With the help of his brother, Richard, Bob Coburg set out to invent his own cow. He brought in Brahmins and crossed them with his English Shorthorns, patiently working down through generations of cattle, until one day a bull calf was born that seemed different. He was so good-natured and playful that they called him Monkey. Monkey was what Bob Coburg had been looking for, and from Monkey he engineered a whole new race of cattle. To breed out undesirable characteristics, he repeatedly mated Monkey to a hand-picked selection of other crossbreeds, then to the best offspring from those matings and to their offspring. He would look at young bulls and heifers and announce that they would mix well together, would produce calves that would continue the progress toward his goal, an animal that would thrive on heat and grass and would repel insects, an animal that had the hardiness of the Brahmin and the temperament and marketable beef of the fat and docile English cattle. His invention was the world's first new breed of beef cattle in more than a century, and in 1940, thanks largely to Richard Coburg's skilled lobbying in Washington, it was officially named the first American breed. Bob Coburg called the new breed the Santa Gertrudis, after the little creek that marked the spot of King's first rancho. The breed reflects Bob's practical genius, but it also confirms his artistic sense. It is an animal of beauty, deep russet in color, long and well proportioned. Like great art, the Santa Gertrudis appears simple, but could only be recreated from scratch with incredible difficulty and a great deal of luck. Technically, it is 3/8 Bremen and 5/8 Schorthorn. But as one geneticist puts it, you could cross Schorthorns and Bremens all your life and not come up with a Santa Gertrudis. Bob Klebold's artistry and genetics wasn't limited to beef cattle. His father had crossed quarter horses with thoroughbreds and standard breeds, but their descendants were too clumsy for ranch work. Bob set out to create a ranch horse that would be, in his words, a joy to ride. The quarter horse he developed, known as the Old Sorrel, from the stallion that was the equine counterpart of Monkey, is a deep red like the Santa Gertrudis. Ringling Brothers bought King Ranch quarter horses for their circus acts, and when the American Quarter Horse Association was founded, a King Ranch stallion, Wimpy, was given the first number in the stud book. In the late 30s, Bob devoted the same interest to thoroughbreds, breeding racehorses that won the Kentucky Derby twice, and, with Assault, the Triple Crown. In each case, he pushed out into the forefront of the geneticist's art and science. Outside the fences. Bob Klebold was the first leader of the King Ranch, born and bred to ranching. He did not share his father's interest in development and growth. If anything, the town Kingsville, his father's personal creation, was an irritant to him. Still, he did not want to let Kingsville leave the ranch's paternal control. The family was proud of the land and money it donated for schools, churches, and social work, not to mention the leadership of generations of ranch women in charitable causes throughout South Texas. Bob Klebold was squarely in that tradition. He saw himself as a patron. In that role, he donated buildings and money for schools, but fought any effort to let the school board tax the ranch to pay for the same improvement. The arrival of a naval air station, Humble, and then the Celanese Chemical Company, combined with the social upheavals that began in earnest after World War II, changed forever the ranch's relationship to Robert Klebold's town. Like a son who had grown to manhood, Kingsville wanted independence from its parents. First, Richard Klebold was defeated for Congress. Then, in the late 40s, Kingsville voted in an anti-ranch school board. But today, the town and the ranch coexist comfortably. The ranch pays about $336,000 in taxes, less than either Celanese or Humble. The streets bear the names of the family, and the ranch still owns the newspaper, the largest bank, a lumber yard, and a boot and saddle shop. But Kingsville and its 29,000 people have grown beyond the ranch, just as the ranch, in its worldwide activities, has grown beyond Kingsville. The family, of course, did not drop out of politics. After Richard broke with the New Deal, the Klebolds gradually became strong Republicans. In 1962, John Armstrong, now the ranch's executive vice president, modernized the Klebold County Republican Party organization and personally helped canvass the whole county. Both Bob Klebold and his nephews, Belton Klebold, B. Johnson, and Dick Klebold, strongly supported Richard Nixon. Dick contributed $100,000 to Nixon's 1972 campaign. And when Nixon resigned the presidency in 1974, a stunned and very distressed Bob Klebold, only 2 months away from death, called one of his relatives to talk for hours about the fate of leaders, about how no man can hold power forever. But in local politics, the ranch takes a lower profile. For a number of Chicano activists, the ranch is too potent a symbol of how Anglo ranchers once controlled the county's destiny. Some individual family members still get involved in city and school elections, and the family-owned newspaper is fairly outspoken on local affairs, but no one in either the town or the family believes the ranch calls the shots in Kingsville anymore. Taxes weren't the only trappings of civilization that Bob resisted. The boom in the valley in South Texas, brought on in part by the success of his father's farming experiments, was attracting too many people, crowding out cattle, eating away at perfectly good ranch land. He ruthlessly set out to stop this encroachment, once calling one of the elder Kleberg's farming proposals a damn fool idea to his face. For almost 10 years, he and Johnny Kennedy, Mifflin Kennedy's grandson, blocked the completion of Highway 77, the main artery between Corpus Christi and Brownsville, because it would pass through their ranches. His opposition to progress earned the ranch its fame as the Walled Kingdom. Miles to go before he slept. When Bob Kleberg went to Australia in 1952, he was 56. The ranch he had run since 1918, when he was 22 years old, was doing well. Now, at a time when many men would have looked back on their accomplishments, he was ready for new challenges. He was irascible, magnetic, imperious, opinionated, able to mix with Vaqueros and Rockefellers, and quite often, absolutely impossible. "I've been out with him when he didn't put head to pillow all night," recalls John Armstrong. "Then he'd saddle up his horse and work cattle until the sun went down the next day, and never slow down. I never knew when he slept, but I started to notice that he would sleep at the dinner table, sometimes over coffee, sometimes through the main course. And then he'd look up with a start and be ready to go again. When you were with him, you were always drinking, laughing, and shooting rabbits. I went with him to South America, and when I came home, I had to see my doctor. I was almost 25 years younger, but he'd worn me out. When he went to the East, to the best boxes at Saratoga, to the suite at the Pierre, to 21, he arrived as the conquering provincial. During the horse racing season, he customarily dressed in a silk hat with a serape and, thus outfitted, went calling on the Whitneys and the Vanderbilts. There was always something fabulous about him, almost as if he'd just ridden up to the Pierre Hotel surrounded by mounted and armed quinonos. What Bob saw, he saw clearly. What Bob wanted done, he got done. He was not plagued by self-doubts or hampered by lack of confidence. He did as he pleased all his life. He knew his own mind, and he knew who he was. Faced with a world in which paperwork, bureaucrats, and experts assumed more importance every day, he became less and less patient with dissent, incompetence, and routine. A lifelong friend casually refers to him as the old dictator. He wanted things done his way. When he said frog, one crusty South Texas rancher in oil man recalls, everybody jumped. Instinct was as important to Bob Kleberg as organization. The management tools used in sedentary pursuits like insurance and steel manufacturing were to be tolerated, but certainly not encouraged. When he went to Venezuela to look into buying a ranch with his partner there, he was presented with a wealth of statistics, charts, and cost-benefit analyses. He brushed them all aside, looked around at the land, opened a bottle, and made the deal. After all, his partner in Venezuela was a man he trusted, a rancher. That bond of respect was worth more than any economic analysis. The partner, Gustavo de los Reyes, had owned a ranch in Cuba, neighboring Bob Kleberg's first foreign venture. After Castro came to power in 1959, de los Reyes was imprisoned, and the king's ranch's property and cattle were expropriated. For years afterward, there were reports of Santa Gertrudis herds in Russia, the older cattle still bearing the ranch's Winning W brand. Kleberg had promised De Los Reyes he would set him up anywhere in the world when he got out of prison, and he kept his promise. In 1966, Bob was visiting the Venezuela ranch. Terrorists had been attacking ranches nearby, and the Venezuelan government seemed powerless to stop them. As De Los Reyes recounted the story to Charles Murphy, a fortune writer, he turned to Kleberg and told him he wouldn't blame him if he wanted to pull out of the Venezuela in order to avoid a repeat of the Cuban affair. Kleberg thought about that. "You ever ran away from anything?" he asked. "Nothing that I can remember," the Cuban answered. "Neither have I," said Captain King's grandson. Bob Kleberg then stood up, took off his King Ranch cowboy hat, and hung it on a hook in the ranch office, where it remained until his death. I'll need this," he said, "when I come back." That was how Bob Kleberg worked, in ranching, in oil, in everything. He had an actor's instinct for the dramatic gesture, particularly the one that would make him seem larger than life. But if he postured, as he did with his hat in Venezuela, he was also willing to back that posturing up. He might, for example, trot out some obscure fact about the Irish Rebellion in 1797 to make a point, but if he was challenged, the chances were very good that he really knew what he was talking about. He did a great deal for effect, but he hardly ever did anything simply for show. A sophisticated businessman, he was a determined foe of what passed for sophisticated business. After he made a deal, he had his lawyers and accountants come in and make sure it was right, but until then, they made themselves scarce. He had a healthy respect for such professionals. His father and brother were both lawyers, and the ranch's main attorneys, Leroy Denham Sr. and Leroy Denham Jr., were two of his closest friends and advisors. But he knew also that a rancher was not a lawyer, and that to be a rancher, you had to know when not to return your lawyer's urgent phone calls. A woman's touch. For the last two decades of his life, Bob Kleberg spent most of his time on his foreign empire. His nephew Dick Kleberg stayed in Texas and ran the original ranch. When Bob was at the ranch, his days almost always followed the same pattern. He was awakened with a steaming cup of black coffee at 5 or 6, talked to all his foremen by phone, and then drove out onto the ranch in one of the special hunting cars he had designed. He never left without his pistols and his Mannlicher rifles. There was always the possibility of some hapless coyote, or during hunting season, quail, turkey, or deer might cross his path. Throughout the day, he would work on horseback with the Canaños. At lunch, they would break for barbecue, frijoles, and camp bread cooked in Dutch ovens over an open fire and smeared with molasses. It was a rugged, hardy, outdoor life. It kept Bob Kleberg in touch with his roots and with the frontier traditions of ranching, and it had almost nothing to do with how the ranch really made its money. When he returned from his sojourns in Australia or South America, Bob made it a point to tour the ranch. His tours were legendary. Often he would take his nephew, B. Johnson, along. "We'd leave at dawn and drive all day long," B remembers. "We'd do 2 and sometimes 3 divisions in a day. You'd get to a pasture, take one look and say, 'I told you 3 years ago to do so-and-so. You didn't do it. See what happened?'" He would work with the Canaños straight through until we finished. No breaks for coffee, lunch, bad weather, or anything. He did everything the hard way. He rode the hard way with his stirrups fully extended. He roped the hard way, just using his shoulders. He studied the hard way, always poring over scientific journals. He hated the office. His life was outside. Bob and his brother and their few close friends entertained themselves much as Captain King had. They hunted, of course, alone and with each other, and on a grand social scale at Christmas time. Both Bob and Richard were superb shots with rifle, pistol, or shotgun. Once Bob and a family friend shot out the streetlights of the nation's capital with wild abandon and great accuracy. Bob and Richard often bet on horses and sneaked away from the respectable life of the family compound to the more plebeian pleasures of cockfighting. Their mother Alice, the last link with the old ranch of Captain King, viewed their excesses with the same blinders her mother had worn. When someone mentioned that her son Richard was spending a good deal of time with fighting cocks, she replied, "How nice. He's the first member of the family to be interested in poultry." But at home, the brothers made the same concessions to respectability their grandfather had. They would, for example, hide liquor in the bathroom and answer a truly prodigious number of calls of nature during parties or in the long evenings they spent at home. Outside the house, they were their own men. Inside, they played by women's rules. But Alice King Kleberg was the last woman of the family to embody the struggle of gentility against reality. The next generation of women was different, as likely to sip bourbon as the men, as eager to go out on roundups, as proficient at riding and shooting. The key woman of that generation was Bob's wife, Helen, the model for Leslie Benedict in Giant. If oil opened the world up to the ranch, it was Helen who pushed it and prodded her reluctant husband out into it. The daughter of a congressman from Kansas, she met Bob Kleberg at a party in 1926. Only 17 days later, they were married. Helen threw herself into the romantic and varied wonders of the ranch, but always, always tried to awaken her provincial husband to what lay beyond its fences. She encouraged him to enter the world of thoroughbred racing, which led them into friendships with old families of the East. She bought her cowboy husband pinstripe suits, which he wore with good humor, even if they never quite seemed to fit. She carried her Episcopalian faith into the Presbyterian stronghold, and determined that her daughter, Helenita, and other promising young Klebergs would be exposed to a wider world, she saw that they went east to prep school. She labored to keep up a sense of standards within the fairly rough-edged family she had joined. She even included the Queen of England on the family's wedding invitation list, a reminder to everyone of exactly where she pegged the Klebergs' social position. Every January at roundup time, Bob and Helen Kleberg worked cattle together. Everyone pitched in for a veritable orgy of work and a hell of a good time. It was as if twice a year John D. Rockefeller went down to the oil field and drilled for oil. Few people of the Kleberg station remained so in touch with the work on which their fortunes were built, and few people of their station could perform the roughest and most challenging tasks as well as their best workers.
Next week, please tune in for part 3 of Texas Monthly Articles about the King Ranch, read by our volunteer, Jack.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 66 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus Updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Dreamscape presents Turkey Day Murder, a Lucy Stone Mystery by Leslie Meyer. narrated by Karen White. After the bright, albeit waning, sunshine outside, it took a few minutes for her eyes to adjust to the dim light inside the barn. It was surprisingly warm, and she pulled off her beret and jammed it in her pocket. "Over here!" yelled O'Hara, and she finally made him out, standing by Tom Tom Turkey's pen. As she got closer and her vision cleared, she was shocked to see he was wearing a leather motocross suit. "I took you for the kind of guy who drives a Lexus or a BMW," she said in a teasing tone. "You'd be right," he said, smiling. "I've got a Lexus, but I ride my bike whenever I can. It's great exercise, and a lot more fun than sweating on a treadmill in some stinking gym." "A lot more dangerous, too," said Lucy, thinking of the cyclist who had harassed her on the back road, and wondering if it could possibly have been O'Hara. She thought of Bear Sykes and his cell phone, but dismissed the thought. It seemed unlikely that O'Hara would be at Sykes's beck and call. It must have been one of the young toughs Ted had told her about. She relaxed. "Where's Andy?" she asked, glancing uneasily at the turkey, who was pacing back and forth in his pen. "I don't think old Tom Tom here cares much one way or the other about the casino." "That's where you're wrong," said O'Hara with mock seriousness. "Before you got here, he was telling me he loves to play blackjack." "I think craps is more his style," said Lucy, wrinkling her nose. "You may be right," agreed O'Hara, unrolling the plans and laying them out on a stack of hay bales. The sun was sinking lower in the sky, and it streamed through the high windows, lighting the entire area in a golden glow. "Andy had to make some phone calls, but he said he'd be right over." Lucy stepped closer, studying the blue and white diagram. "This is what they call an elevation," O'Hara said. "It shows what the casino will look like from the southeast, actually the main entrance." Lucy looked at the rounded awning, which was reminiscent of a longhouse. She noticed the carvings of a bear and turtle that stood on either side of the doorway. Her eyes followed the soaring lines of the hotel tower, and she counted the rows of windows. 14 stories. It seemed so big. Bigger than anything we've ever seen in Tinker's Cove. "I know, but what would you rather have? A tall building like this, or a sprawling complex covering acres of land?" "I guess I never thought of it that way," said Lucy. "This is so much more economical. It's energy efficient." O'Hara paused, looking at her. "You know, I'll never understand you country folk. You got all this empty land, acres and acres of it, and you all act like one building is going to spoil it. What gives?" Lucy shrugged. "People around here like it the way it is." "I noticed." He tapped the plans with his finger. "You can't hold back progress, you know. Whether you like it or not, things are going to change in Tinker's Cove, with or without the casino. If the tribe gets federal recognition, the whole balance of power is going to change. It won't be Howard White and his buddies calling the shots anymore. And your boss, Ted? He's awfully cocky for a guy whose entire livelihood is tied up in that rickety newspaper. I mean, think what one carelessly thrown match could do to that place." Lucy's head jerked up, and she stared at O'Hara. "Is that why you had me come here? To send a message to Ted that you're going to torch the penny saver if he doesn't support the casino?" O'Hara had been getting the full force of the slanting sunlight. It was so bright, it illuminated the dancing dust particles in the air. Beads of perspiration had formed on his upper lip, and he wiped them away with his hand. "You've got me wrong," said O'Hara, unzipping his jacket. "I just think people should think things through before they make big decisions." "That's good advice for—" began Lucy, stammering to a halt as her eyes fell on the short black thread that dangled from the neck of his sweater. It should have held a button, a woven leather button, just like the ones that remained. "Well, for anyone," she continued brightly, hoping he hadn't noticed her staring. "It's just common sense," she babbled on, wondering if O'Hara's missing button was the missing button. "What my mother used to tell me, think before you speak." O'Hara nodded and leaned forward to pull out another plan, and she instinctively stepped back. He looked at her curiously. "I think if you keep an open mind when you look at these plans, you'll have to agree the casino could be a real asset to the town. Look here, we've used a woodland theme. A brook with waterfalls actually runs through the gaming area, and there will be recordings of birdsong. The furniture will be Adirondack style, like a lodge, right down to a gigantic fieldstone fireplace." He tapped the plan with his finger, inviting Lucy to step forward and take a closer look. She knew she should do it, but she couldn't make her feet move. All she could think about was that missing button. "I know casinos aren't everybody's cup of tea."